My Word. A panel game devised by Tony Schryan and Edward J. Mason. Dennis Powell and Frank Muir challenge Anne Scott James and Dennis Norton in a game about words. And here's your chairman, Jack Longland.
Well, we go straight into round one, and that tries to test the respective vocabularies. For 2 marks, can you give me the meaning of the following words? And to this part, it's you to start. What is a myriolog? M-Y-R-I-O-L-O-G-U-E, myriolog.
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 You sure that O hasn't gotten to the wrong place, uh-huh?
Well, I think it has, myself, and my dictionary confirms what you're saying. You're being extremely erudite.
Well, no, I'm not being erudite, but I have spent a certain amount of time in the island of Crete.
Yes, you're very close to where these things happen.
Well, in Crete, the local people, who are very, very nice, have a habit of inventing their own songs.
Yes.
Which are called myrologia, not myriologia.
Yeah,
myrologia.
Mm-hmm.
Would that help?
It would help enormously. This is a song of a rather sad kind.
Well, somebody's dead, I should think.
Absolutely right. Well done, Dillis. It's an off-the-cuff funeral song composed and sung by a woman about somebody whom she loves who is dead. Well done. 2 marks, Dillis. Dennis Norton, what is a Waterbury? Just like that, water and B-U-R-Y put together. Waterbury.
Water, B-U-R-Y.
Yes.
Wouldn't be kind of maritime undertaker.
No, that won't help.
Is there any clue at all in the word? Is it anything to do with water or...
None whatever.
Not political.
No, it isn't. Curious enough. A later version of much the same object was called Ingersoll.
Just a watch.
Yes, it's the cheap watch. They were originally manufactured by the Waterbury Clock Company of Waterbury, Connecticut, United States. And a later example, I think, which I had when I was a boy, was a thing called Ingersoll, which then was 5 bob. Now it's Anne Scott James' turn. Anne, what is a snicker snee? S-N-I-C-K-E-R, S-N-E-E, snicker snee.
Hmm. Well, as in the case of that Cretan word, I think a letter's got transposed, and it should be knicker's knee. And it's a kind of short pair of cycling pantaloons.
It's short, but it's not a pair of cycling pantaloons.
Are you not agreeing with me that a letter's got transposed?
No, not allowing you any of that.
Well, then it's a sort of a giggle. Snicker's knee, you know, sort of...
It produces something...
A sly, wry, a boring kind of laugh at an inferior joke.
Yeah, I think you would not find this a joke at all if it was used against you.
If it was used against you,
Is it some
kind weapon?
Yes.
Yeah. A
catapult, the kind of thing that David used against Goliath.
I think of
a sling and a sling.
Does it sound much like that, a snicker snee?
No, it sounds like a thing that you cut undergrowth with.
A thing you cut grass with.
Yep.
A flick knife.
Yes, it. That's it. It's near enough. 1.5. It's a cut-and-thrust knife used very much in infighting. It's mentioned in the Mikado. And two snickersnees is to do somebody in that way. I think about 1.5. Frank Muir, what is the meaning of rantipole? R-A-N-T-I-P-O-L-E, rantipole.
Rantipole. It's a condition of, isn't it? Pole.
No, I don't think it'll help.
It's 16th or 17th century, isn't it?
Yes, it's exactly 1700.
Oh, that was half a mark's worth, isn't it? In anybody's money. Rantipole.
It's a rantipole.
A rantipole? Is it a chap?
Mm.
A very jolly one.
Yes.
It's a very jolly one.
Is it a rodomontada?
Not far wrong.
Well, three quarters of a mark. Is it a chap who bags and blusters?
Yes, this'll do, yes. You've not got quite the right nuance, but you're very much in the right or street.
There is a song, I'm sure, a story that Gladstone used to dance round the bed with his wife, calling her a rantipoling wife.
Yes, that's the other meaning of it.
So it seems highly unlikely.
I think you're going to get your two marks. In Dillis's sense, it's a romp used as describing that kind of female who danced like anything. When it refers mainly to males, it's a wild, ill-behaved, or reckless person. It can also, in a rather nasty way, again with women, mean a termagant or scold. I think you're near enough to get your two. The origin, how it came to mean this, is totally obscure. At this point, I give Frank and Dennis quotations, one each, to think about for their stories in the last round. And Frank, yours is "Pop Goes the Weasel," and yours, Dennis, is "Hard Words Break No Bones." And now we have a round of origins and derivations. This is a team effort. For two marks, the teams have got to tell me how the following words or phrases originated or were derived, and they can do it together if they find it at all easier. Dennis Powell and Frank Muir, your word is laconic. L-A-C-O-N-I-C.
Laconic?
Laconic.
Well, that comes from the Greek, doesn't it?
Yes.
The Greek conic. Laconic.
Laconia it comes from.
And where was that?
It comes from Laconia, where Sparta was.
And what did it mean?
Well, it would mean that if a fox bit your vitals, you wouldn't say a word.
And perhaps if you were saying any words, what would they be?
Very brief, such as four. Usually about four letters.
I can't fault them, this is absolutely right. It means of or pertaining to Laconia, which is the part of Greece where Sparta was. And the Spartans were noted for being very brusque and sententious in their speech. And so it means very concise or pithy, your money or your life, something like that. Two marks. And Scott James and Dennis Norton, yours is galoshes, G-A-L-O-S-H-E-S. Or you can spell it G-O-L.
I think
it's an onomatopoeic. It's for going glosh
in
the mud, yeah. In puddles.
Yeah.
We think this is a highly...
If you wear loose galoshes and you walk through a puddle, it goes glosh.
And I think they started with Jeremy Fisher, don't you think?
And they started a long way back beyond Jeremy Fisher.
Yeah.
In fact, in the kind of time about which the last question, which had just been answered, was...
Listen, galos, the Greek for milk. So it's the sound of milk.
Most
not,
ingenious.
Not what you may think.
Most ingenious.
Overshoes. But in fact...
No, they weren't originally.
I don't think of the Spartans as wearing galoshes. No, if they could let a fox bite their vitals, surely they could walk through puddles without galoshes.
Just a thumb or two. Yeah.
Yes, but before
Are you attributing it to the Greek period, the classic Greek period?
I am, yes. Yes, and before they had rubber galoshes, there were other ways of keeping your feet out of the wet.
Stilts.
Yes, well, very tiny stilts.
Sort of.
That's right. Galoshes comes from a Spanish word, galosha, meaning wooden shoes, or in French similarly, and they both probably come from kalopaus, Greek word, meaning a shoemaker's last, which was also wooden. And the original galoshes were not these funny rubbery things we wear, but clogs or pattens to protect rather valuable cloth shoes. And they not only were Greek, but they go right back to Chaucer and William Langton.
They also go
back beyond
Mersey Doats, actually. As the last time it goes, a kiddly divey to wooden shoe.
That's it. Greek to start with, and the galosha, Spanish and French, and medieval, certainly. And here we have some dialect words. Variants of the English still spoken in certain parts of Britain, though not perhaps all of these are spoken today. And these are groups of five dialect words in each case, and they all mean the same thing. They're five of a kind.
A gift. Must be a gift.
Well, for two marks, I want to know what they do mean. We begin again with Dillis Powell. What to be found on a person's person... are farn tickles, summer voys, frackens, Muffles or Muffles? Do you want any of those spelt?
It wouldn't help.
Found upon a person.
Found on a person.
They're warts, must be.
Isn't there warts?
Warts.
They're alive.
Warts is a little too obtrusive. You're in the right class.
Obtrusive, they obtrude warts. Now, what are these seeds? Dimples.
Well, you're getting, yes, halfway between the two would get you there.
What? Freckles.
Yes.
Freckles.
Halfway between a wart and a dimple, I think a freckle is exactly that. These are dialect words for what we normally call freckles. Well done, 2 marks. Now, Dennis Norton, these are things that go on top of other things, and they are cobble ducks, sarsens, muffeties, wyvets, and viscountesses.
These are dialect words for corns, I suppose. You say, I've got a right wyvet on my left. My viscountess is really giving me jip today. I can tell it's going to rain.
Building word.
It's a building word, right?
That's right.
A sarsen is a stone.
That's it.
Oh, yes, that's right.
You're in the right class.
And do we have cobble?
I said things that go on top of
cobble,
other things.
Cobble or something it was, didn't it?
No. Think of the sort of toppetiest thing you can think of.
Chimneys.
Oh, no, you beat me. I'm sorry, I forgot them.
Television. Well, it's dialect words, old-fashioned 16th century dialect words. But televisionary, they had the power of the sight in those days.
Now, disregard things that stick out of the top of your house and concentrate on the top, Dennis.
The roof.
Yes. What are these? Different kinds of?
Roofing.
Yes, and a particular?
Tiles.
Tiles or thatch. Slates.
Yes.
Thank you. The sibilant S in your
tarpaulin.
You prep.
Corrugated iron. Started.
You crept home, 1.5. These are slates of different sizes used for roofing. And now, Anne Scott James, what in children's vocabulary are scribs, screams, skinch, boozy, or blobs?
Ink blots.
No, it's an activity or the end of an activity.
It isn't one of those sort of tossing up games, what we used to call tossing up games, where you pick teams, where you pick sides.
No, it's the end of something which has been happening, and that something was very disputatious.
It was a fight, actually.
Yes.
Yeah.
And the end of the fight, how do you bring the fight to an end, apart from knocking somebody out?
I used to cry.
Yes, but just before you started crying, you uttered a word.
Oh, it's like Fainites.
Yes, that's right.
Pack it in. Did you ever
say... Yes, this is it.
We did not fight in May school. We merely bitched each other all the time.
I thought I used to fight with your school. I wouldn't fight with any of the fellas in my school.
Well, I think 1.5 again. These are children's words of truce, the most commonly known, which I didn't use, being packs.
We didn't used to say packs in council schools.
Well, you almost certainly said scribs or blobs. No. All right, 1.5. Frank Muir, what would you be if you were Kervag, Corrie Flug, Cuddy Wifted, Pally Cluckett, or Marlborough?
Drunk.
That might be a bonus added in, but it isn't exactly the description I want.
You can't just sort of toss this arm full of weirdos at us like that. What are they?
Kervag, Corrie Flug.
What's Kervag?
K-E-R-V-A-G. Cuddy or Cuddy Wifted. Pally Cluckett. Cuddy. Or Marlborough.
I know Marlborough. Marlborough means left-handed.
And so do all the others. And now we come to the last round and go back to those quotations I gave Frank and Dennis at the beginning of the program. On this occasion, the marks will be awarded on the length of the applause from the audience here in the theatre. And if you remember, Frank, your quotation is, "Pop goes the weasel." Frank.
Well, yes. I was thinking about food the other day. I was on the 11:30 Manchester to Euston train in the dining car. I'd almost completed my luncheon, and I wasn't entirely happy. The reasons for this were several. One was that the fish that day was off. It was on, but it was off. Long time no see. And I wrestled for 10 minutes with a tiny white plastic cube wherein lay a small piece of frozen, unspreadable butter. And I couldn't get it open, and eventually I did, and the lid flicked off and hit the man opposite me on his forehead, which he dabbed with a handkerchief all the way to Euston, looking at me. And also the waiter with the coffee pot was standing in the aisle beside me, talking to somebody, and at each lurch of the train, a small spurt of hot coffee went into my left ear. And it made me think about food. Now, normally I don't bother with food. I never eat very much. I eat hardly anything at all, except at mealtimes, of course. But it did make me consider food and what the present-day living is doing to our food. What have they done? If I could sing, which I can, I would sing, what have they done to our bread, Ma? What have they done to our loaf? Does anybody here remember bread? Any of you old enough to remember bread? I mean, before this poly-extruded polyurethane bread substitute that we get. Do you remember a cottage loaf? It came, and you could tap your fingernail against it, and it rang hard, and there was an echo inside the loaf. Do you remember that? And you had to hold it down with your left hand and cut it, not with a knife, but with a saw. And when you cut off one slice, your hair and your turnips were full of sharp pieces of crust. But now, I mean, nowadays, the bread is sort of all of a piece. They spray on a bit of brown on the outside for colouring. And it's wrapped like a pair of loo rolls. You can't even toast it. If you drop a couple of slices in the toaster, they wilt and they sort of sag. And fried eggs. Do you remember real fried eggs? Where they've got lumps of dirt all over them. And the edge is crisp and crackly and black or brown and curly. I mean, that's so that if you're having breakfast in bread, you can hook your fork into the stiff edge and convey it to your mouth. Nowadays, fried eggs in a hotel or in a boarding house or anywhere, they're sort of oily and hygienic. And if you try and put a bit of white into your mouth from a fork, it slithers down your chest. Ends up in your navel. Anybody old enough to remember rissoles? All the old meat bits and onion and herbs and a bit of egg and all clamped together between the sweaty palms of the cook, moulded into shape and fried. Nowadays, it's the only thing you can get remotely like a rissole is a hamburger. And you have to go to pop places like the American Disaster or the American Success or Hard Rock to buy the modern equivalent of the rissole, and pop music going in one ear and out of the other and eating off plates with pop art on them. Oh, rather sad, isn't it? I don't mind really the way things are going, that tasteless goes our bread and dull goes our breakfast. But I think it's terribly sad that pop goes the rissole.
A very sad story, which obviously many people recognize as not too inaccurate, and we could pass on rapidly to Dennis Norton. If you remember, his phrase was, hard words break no bones, which is a proverb, and you'll find it in Anthony Trollope, The Last Chronicles of Barchester. Dennis.
Why is it, I ask this advertising man, why is it one never sees a commercial with an unhappy ending. The advertising man was beginning to look vaguely uncomfortable and very slightly hunted. Perhaps I should explain that we were the only two people in the lift, and it had stuck between floors. I'd pressed the alarm bell, and someone below had shouted, "Don't worry, the engineer's on his way." Now, that had been 6 hours ago, and there we'd stood, two complete strangers, for 6 hours. Look, I said, going back to commercials, I think the reason why commercials are so basically unconvincing is that you advertising people, you really have no connection with reality. Look, I said, take that commercial that shows that plateful of porridge that gives a small boy energy. And do you honestly think that's what real people want? What people really need is a porridge that will drain the energy out of a small boy. What you ought to do with that commercial, I said, is sort of reverse it. You see, you start with a 12-year-old boy who's yelling and jumping and stamping around the room while his father, who's had a hard day's work, is trying just to read the newspaper, just a while, just to get a moment's peace, that's all. And you show how after eating a plateful of porridge, the child is rendered listless and passive and inert all the way till bedtime. Now, with that commercial, I said, you put that commercial on, you wouldn't be able to get near the supermarket because of the crowd. Because that, I said, is truth. Well, the advertising man stopped sawing at the floor with his penknife. He'd be trying to gouge out a round hole that he could lower himself through. And he turned to me and he said, "What," he said, "is this sudden mad urge that all you consumers seem to have nowadays for truth?" And he got to his feet, which was a mistake. Because it meant he now had his full weight on the area of floor that he'd been sawing round. And then there was a slight rending sound, the circle of floor dropped away, and he disappeared through the hole. Did I mention that the lift was between the fifth and sixth floor? I dropped to my knees and peered down, and he was lying in a peculiarly twisted position. He claimed, "Sir, it was entirely your fault." The character voice there is an attempt to reproduce what the police sergeant on the ground floor said to me when I was finally rescued. He said, May I ask you, sir, what you did to him? I said, "I didn't do anything to him. Nothing. I was merely giving him my theories about adverts." "But he's got 18 multiple fractures." "In which case, Sergeant," I said, "it cannot be my fault." "And why not, sir?" "Because," I said, and I quoted the proverb, "adverts break no bones."
When I think that I've been in a lift with Dennis, I shall know what to avoid in future. And by your vote, ladies and gentlemen, Dennis Norden wins the contest of the two stories, but for the programme as a whole, the winners are Dillis Powell and Frank Muir, and that brings to an end this edition of My Word.
In My Word, you heard Dilys Powell, Anne Scott James, Frank Muir and Dennis Norden, introduced by Jack Longland, with questions compiled by Peter Moore. The program was devised by Tony Shryan and Edward J. Mason and presented by the BBC.